Let's get our Bibles and open up to Luke chapter 21. Last week we covered four verses, verses 1 through 4. And if you thought that was bad, you better hang on to your seat because we're only going to do half as much this week. We're only going to take a look at two verses. Now, relax. We've only got three chapters left in Luke after this chapter. So we're getting there. We're going to get it done. But today we're going to slow down and give ourselves a good setup for our study in verse 7 next week, which begins what is commonly known as the Olivet Discourse, the most thorough and powerful prophetic end-time message that Jesus gave while on the earth. I know I told you we were going to get into that this week. I apologize for the false advertising. We're just going to work on our setup this week, and we'll dive into that next week, so be patient with me. But as I was praying about this message today and taking into consideration the pre-message church business that we needed to get through, I thought maybe it would be best if we just slowed down and just took a look at these two verses. To make a long story short, we'll just take these two verses and make a short story long. See, Jason, I used that already. He taught me that on Friday night. We're going to take this short story and make a short story long. Just as Jason would do in his storytelling. All right? I'll see if I can do it too. So let's begin reading at verse 5. Then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, verse 6. And before we read verse 6, let's talk about verse 5. They are not yet on the Mount of Olives. That is going to begin in verse 7. By the time we get to verse 7, Jesus and the disciples will be on the Mount of Olives. But verses 5 and 6 take place right in front of the temple. Both Matthew and Mark, in those parallel accounts that I gave you last week as references, point that out to us, that Jesus was in the court of women. And we know that because the court of women was where they set up those offering boxes, the treasury. And that was where people would enter into in order to give of their offerings. And there we found Jesus last week watching those offering boxes in the court of women and paying particular attention to how people gave. Not so much what they gave, but paying particular attention to how they gave, the position of their heart, the attitudes, the emotions of the giving. And it was a good study reminder for us that the Lord pays attention to us during our offering time. It's not just an insert into the worship service, sort of like one of those throwaway things. We just do it because, you know, necessary evil, we have to get it done. No, this is something that the Lord cherishes and honors when our giving is right. It is something that he pays attention to, and it would be good for us, according to what we learned last week, to also give that our utmost care and attention. Pay attention to the position of your heart when you give. The Lord is concerned about how you give and not what you give. But now Matthew chapter 24, verse 1 tells us that Jesus has come out of the temple area. He's come out of the courtyard of the women. And his disciples grab him. You can read that in Matthew 1 and Mark's parallel account. His disciples grab him and say, "Lord, check out the masonry work of the temple. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it magnificent? Lord, we understand what you've been teaching us about the corruption that's inside of the temple. There's a lot of corruption inside of the temple because people are going to be people. But Lord, the outside of the temple, it's just absolutely nothing but beauty." As if the Lord was going to say, "Oh, wow, I never noticed that before." It's not as if, I'm God or anything. It's not as if I haven't been here on various trips before. I wish the Lord would have just blew their minds and said, if you think this temple's something, you should have seen when they were building Solomon's temple. I watched that from the throne. That was a magnificent temple. That would have blown their minds. But the disciples are right here. This temple was really incredible and just absolutely beautiful. The stones were quite impressive. The stones in the retaining wall there on the Temple Mount were significantly smaller than the ones used in the temple, but even those smaller stones used in the retaining wall were massive. Now, those stones that were used in the building of the temple, they were extremely large. They were approximately 45 feet long, 10 feet tall, and over 15 feet thick. They weighed over 400 tons. Just to help you with a little perspective, we could fit exactly two of those in our sanctuary. That's how big they were. And we'd have to cut the roof off of our sanctuary to get them in here. We'd have to use one of those industrial cranes to move around 400 tons with each stone, because most cranes only can move around a couple tons here and there. So these were massive stones that were used in the construction of the temple. The temple was made out of limestone, and the pillars of the temple were carved out of solid marble. It was a beautiful thing. It was a sight to behold. The historian Josephus tells us that you could see the temple from 30 miles away, and that it would just look like a ball of light sitting up on the hilltop. And we're told from historians that if you were in the city anywhere near the temple and the sun was glistening off the temple, you couldn't even look at it. You know how white limestone is, and you know how shiny marble is. It was an incredibly beautiful, splendid thing that was, during the sunshine, so bright that it hurt the eyes. The Talmud tells us that if you've never seen the temple, then you have never seen a truly magnificent structure. And I think I'd have to agree with that. It is tough to really do justice to the temple and how incredible it was with the depictions that we have. But I want to do that real quick. Again, this is all just preparation for our build into next week. But if we could pull up this video, this is a video of the, it's a model that is set up over there in Israel. It is a model of the temple, actually the entire city of Jerusalem. And I want you to see this just to give you an idea of some of the things we're talking about here. Now, we start on the east side wall. Can you pause that for a minute? We start on the east side wall. So this is it, as if you were standing on the Mount of Olives, where Jesus is shortly going to move to in order to give this discourse about the end times prophecy that he's going to give us. So this is from the east side. This is what you'd see if you were standing on the Mount of Olives and viewing the city of Jerusalem. You see here we have the wall around the city of Jerusalem. And go ahead and move down it. And I'm just going to point out a few things here as we go. All right, pause it right there. You see that structure? I'm going to walk up to it and point to it because I don't have one of those little red dot things that you torture cats with. I don't have a pointer, so that right there is the Pool of Bethesda. Does that sound familiar? That's the place where that guy that was laying there for 38 years trying to get to the pool to be the first one into the water when the water stirred so that he could be healed. You remember that story from the Gospel of John? That's it. That's the Pool of Bethesda. All right, go ahead and move down. So we're moving down now. All right, pause it right here. Now, this four-tower structure right here is known as the Antonio Fortress. You can't tell yet, but you're going to see when we keep moving. This here is part of the temple structure. And this Antonio Fortress was built right on to the very side of the temple area by Pontius Pilate. The reason he did this was because the Jews were known to have their scuffles. And so in order to keep peace and be right there in the center of action, Pontius Pilate added that structure, the Antonio Fortress, right on to the side of the temple. You can imagine how that would grate at the Jews, having a Gentile fortress right there connected to the temple itself, the holy temple itself. Okay, go ahead and move down. We're following the wall of Jerusalem. All right, pause it right there, I guess. What we're looking at here is the retaining wall on the Temple Mount area, the smaller stones. Inside here we have, beginning with the courtyards, we'll get a better view of that once we do an overhead. What you're looking at right there is the temple itself, and you can't tell how big it is. This is just a model, and you can't really see what's behind it. But the temple was 150 feet high. Again, to help you with perspective, right now, very near this location, on top of the Temple Mount area, sits what? The Dome of the Rock, the Muslim mosque. And that temple that you're looking at right there is 150 feet. It is three times as high as the Dome of the Rock that sits on top of the Temple Mount area in Jerusalem this very day. All right, go ahead and scroll. Here you see this gate. You can keep moving, but that is the Eastern Gate. Actually, go ahead and pause it. That Eastern Gate is very significant because that's the gate where all of the animal sacrifices were brought in during Passover and, you know, during those observances of the sacrificial system. That's the gate. And the Lord, of course, responds to the East Gate in Bible prophecy, but that's beyond scope today. Go ahead and keep scrolling. Pause. If you see this structure right here, you'll get a better look at it from an overhead, but that is Solomon's Porch. Have you heard of that one? Solomon's Porch. It's just a huge, like, awning thing. It's a colonnade, a covered colonnade. It takes up the whole side of that entire temple area. All right, go ahead and scroll. All right, we're just making our way down the wall there. You can keep going. That is just following around the city of Jerusalem. You can see the houses packed in there. You can see some of the other structures. You can see the wall making its bend right there. And I think now we go to an overhead. There we go. All right, so that's the Antonio Fortress. A better look at it. Now we're moving into the temple area. You have the outer courtyard. You have the outer courtyard surrounding the whole thing. Here you have the courtyard of women, which is where they kept the treasury boxes, the place that Jesus has just left. And then in here you have, right before this structure, in the next... Go ahead and pause it. Oh, perfect, actually. This additional little courtyard outside of the temple itself was called the courtyard of the priests. And then inside the temple there were two compartments. There was what was known as the holy place, that first section that you entered into, where there were instruments of worship and they did sacrifices and things like that. And then the next compartment of the temple, the furthest back in, was the Holy of Holies that only one man entered into every year. Okay, go ahead and scroll through. I think that's about all that I wanted to show you. All right, good. So you see there, hopefully you can tell a little bit from the model that the temple and the whole temple area was a massive structure. It sat on a 36-acre complex, and you may not be able to tell from that depiction, but just incredible structures that were built there. Here is the fascinating thing, at least to me. All of those stones that you saw in the retaining wall, in the Temple Mount, in the structure surrounding the temple, in the temple itself, those were all quarried outside of the Temple Mount area, outside of the city of Jerusalem, down in the valley. They were quarried, they were hammered, they were chiseled, and they were made so that when the time came for the building of the temple, they could bring those giant stones, and just like building a Lincoln log structure, bring them up to the Temple Mount area and lay them in place. It is still a mystery to us to this day exactly how they did that with, you know, pulleys and levers. We need massive equipment to be able to pull that off today. It is amazing that they were able to accomplish it. But let me read something to you. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 7. And then I'm going to make some comments about this passage. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 7 reads like this: "And the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone," and this was limestone. And scripture goes on to say, "It was finished at the quarry so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built." Now, it is true. That passage is speaking to us about the building of Solomon's temple, the first temple. And the temple that Jesus and the disciples are standing outside of right here in Luke chapter 21, verses 5 and 6, is Zerubbabel's temple, or Zerubbabel's temple that was almost entirely renovated by Herod the Great. So you had your pick what you wanted to call it. You could call it Zerubbabel's temple. You could call it Herod's temple. You could call it the second temple. You could call it the third temple. But it was the second temple that was renovated by Herod the Great. Herod the Great was well known for his building. And Herod did this in order to try to win over the favor of the Jews, because the Jews didn't like him for, I guess you would say, good reasons. Number one, the Jews didn't select Herod the Great to be the king of the Jews. He was appointed by Rome. They didn't like that. Secondly, Herod the Great was an Idumean. That means he was from the lineage of Esau. He wasn't really a Jew. And Herod the Great thought, you know, if I can fix their holy place for them, if I can build them a really nice, really big, really shiny temple, maybe I'll win their favor and approval. Well, of course, it didn't work. They loved the temple. They loved the temple structures, but Herod the Great was never, of course, going to win their affections. Now, the thing is, the reason I read that verse to you is because they took the same approach with the building of Zerubbabel's temple. In fact, many of the stones in place for Zerubbabel's temple were remnants from Solomon's temple. Anything that they could still use, they did. And the same goes with the building of, or I should say the renovating of Zerubbabel's temple by Herod the Great. But the same approach was used in every situation. They did all of the quarrying down there in the valley where they could get the limestone, where they could dig into the rock. They did all of the quarrying down there. They got those pieces perfect. They brought them up. They set them in place. And history tells us that the abutment of all of those stones was so perfect and so precise that you couldn't fit a piece of parchment paper between the stones. So, just amazing work. Now, I'm kind of camping out on this point today because I see a great metaphor in here for us. Just think about this for a minute. All of the cutting, all of the chipping, all of the hammering, all of the chiseling took place in the rock quarry and not in the holy city. That is a great metaphor for the church because of what the Apostle Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Let me read that to you, and if you have your Bibles with you, you can read along with me. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5, Peter says this, speaking to the church, "You also, as living stones," or as the King James Version says, "as lively stones, are being built up a spiritual house." All right, I love this metaphor because the Apostle Peter tells us that God is building a holy habitation in heaven. God is building a living temple, and God has chosen to use us as the living stones that comprise that temple. And when we get to heaven, all of the hammering and chiseling in our lives will have all been said and done. and we're going to fit together like a glove. But what does that say about time on earth? As far as earth is concerned, that means what? It means that earth is the rock quarry. This earth, our life on earth, our time spent on this earth is nothing more than the spiritual rock pit. This is where we are being prepared for that holy habitation that Peter speaks of in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. To take that a step further, stones do what? Nothing. It wasn't a trick question. Stones are inanimate objects. They do nothing. But what do you suppose that living stones do? Well, living stones, they're alive, so they move around. And when I think of the church as living stones or lively stones, I get the point that the Lord is making. We're a lively bunch. We move around. We live our lives, and we're going to bump into one another from time to time. And we're going to rub each other the wrong way from time to time. But instead of having a chip on your shoulder about that, how about you take a lesson from the metaphor, and instead of having a chip on your shoulder, remember that this is just the rock pit. And you're a living stone that the Lord is carving out for a future habitation in heaven. And that while we're here on the earth, the Lord is going to use our brothers and sisters and unbelievers as well to hammer away at us, to chip away at us, to rub us the wrong way from time to time in order to knock off our rough edges. So, it is why fellowship is so important to us. One of the many reasons why fellowship is so important to us. The scriptures tell us in Proverbs, iron sharpens iron. It's the same concept. Those uncomfortable relationships that you have with people in the church shouldn't be things that keep you out of church. They should be accomplishing what God has meant for them to accomplish. They should be helping to chip away at the rough edges that we have, help us to sharpen down to the edges that the Lord wants us to have, and eventually sculpt us into exactly the way that the Lord would want us to look. Yeah, well, I don't go to church because, man, those church people, they just rub me the wrong way. Well, if that's your thought on the matter, I think that's probably because you have a lot of rough edges. And the Lord is using brothers and sisters to try to chip away at that stuff and break that stuff away from you so that you can look more like Him. And it's probably just that rub between you and that brother or sister or that uncomfortable relationship that has formed there is likely because you've got rough edges that the Lord wants to do some work on. He will use brothers and sisters for that. Jesus told us in John chapter 14, verse 2, I go to prepare a place for you. But at the same time, Jesus is also preparing us for the place. It's sort of just like that 1 Kings chapter, who was it? Chapter 6, verse 7 passage that we read. There is no chipping and hammering in heaven. When it is time for you to stand before the Lord, all of the work is done. There's no time to brush up. There's no time to correct or fix things. The Lord is preparing us for that day so that when that day comes, we are assembled as a holy habitation and we fit. Because earth served its purpose and ran its course and made us the people that God destined and designed us to be in heaven. One of my favorite verses, as you know, Philippians chapter 1, verse 6. The Lord has promised that He's going to complete that work in us. So He is going to get that work done and turn you into that lively stone that he desires. A beautiful stone in the temple of the Lord in heaven. These beautiful stones that these disciples were looking at, as we're going to find out next week, or no, actually this week, they're going to get discarded. They're going to get destroyed. They're going to get unstacked. But the stones that the Lord is making in the church, the beautiful stones that he is shaping and preparing, he has that future destiny for us, and he's going to get it done. Verse 6. These things which you see, speaking about the stones in the temple, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. Or as Matthew 24:2 records, not one stone is going to be left stacked on top of another. Jesus, what do you think about this beautiful temple? Isn't it marvelous? Here's Jesus. It's all coming down. It's not going to last. Not a stone is going to be left unturned when the Lord pours out his wrath in the city of Jerusalem. Now, we've covered this multiple times at this fellowship, so you must know by now that this is referencing the overthrow of Jerusalem by the Romans under General Titus in 70 AD. I know we've discussed that quite a bit, so I'm just going to move past that. But I do want to say this. It must have been absolutely unfathomable, impossible to believe that this would come to pass exactly as Jesus spoke it. I would think it would be one of those times where they thought, you know, the Lord must be speaking metaphorically again. He does that a lot. He must be spiritualizing something, and there must be something deeper behind what he's saying, because surely he doesn't mean that these massive stones that we could only get two of here in this sanctuary, surely Jesus doesn't mean that every single one of these stones is going to be plucked up and thrown off of the other. And yet this happened incredibly, exactly as Jesus prophesied. Do you remember why that was? Why was it that the Romans, after laying siege to and overthrowing the city of Jerusalem, went through and plucked up every single stone off of the other? Does anyone remember why they did that? To get the melted gold that ran down the cracks of those stones. That's why they did it. If you don't know what we're talking about here, I encourage you to go back through our Luke studies so that you can catch up with us. But for now, the rest of us are going to move on with or without you. So now let's take a look. At this point in verse 6 for just a few minutes, no surprise to us that Jesus was right. Jesus and the boys have left the temple complex, and they are heading to the Mount of Olives, where Jesus is going to give the Olivet Discourse. We're going to cover that next week, but spend just a few minutes here as they're heading out toward the Mount of Olives to just discuss what we see here in verse 6. There's something that you absolutely must know in preparation for next week's study. Something that you absolutely must know in order to decipher the prophecy that Jesus has given to us in the Olivet Discourse. You must know that when Jesus answers the question that his disciples are going to pose, he does so with two separate intended realities in mind. In one discourse, Jesus predicts both near prophecy for the Jews and far prophecy for the world. That is not always how Bible prophecy works. But it is the case quite often. It was very often the method of Old Testament prophecy, where an Old Testament prophet would give a prophecy to their generation that would have a near fulfillment. It would come to pass in short order. But then in that same prophecy, we see the characters of the Bible taking that same prophecy that had a literal and near fulfillment and using that as a model for something much greater with far worse implications in a far yet future prediction. So that's how Jesus answers when he gives the answer that he does in this chapter concerning eschatology, end time prophecy. If you don't really get that, if you don't really get that there are two different realities to many prophecies in the scripture, you are going to have a very hard time deciphering Bible prophecy. You just can't do it. I could give you examples of this if time permitted, but you just have to take a look at the scriptures for yourself to understand that what I'm telling you is the truth. And if you don't really get this, the Olivet Discourse is going to be impossible for you to interpret, because one minute it's going to sound like Jesus is speaking about that 70 AD event, and the next minute it is going to sound like he is talking about the tribulation period that we read of in Revelation. That is because his response is both with the near and far in mind. I can give you some help with that if you want it. As a matter of fact, I already have. I would encourage you to revisit. I know I gave you homework last week and we didn't even get to it. But I'm going to give you a little more homework. I would encourage you to get on anchoredfellowship.com and pull up that topical message that we did called Overview of Eschatology. That was posted on February the 5th of last year. And in that overview of prophecy, we went through all of the big events of Bible prophecy. We started with the pre-tribulation events. We spoke about the rapture. We spoke about the seven-year tribulation period, at the end of which we have the second coming of Jesus Christ. At that time, we have the beginning of that 1,000-year millennial reign of Christ. And then at the end of that, Satan has been bound for those 1,000 years. That's why we have the peace that we do during the millennial kingdom. But after that 1,000 year of Christ's reign on the earth, as the physical king over all the earth, Satan is loosed along with the fallen angels for a short period of time, at which time he raises up a rebellion and leads them to that final battle against God and the wicked. And it's not much of a showdown. The Lord doesn't have to really exert any energy to win that final battle. And at that point, the wicked are forever cast away into the lake of fire, Gehenna. And then all that's left is this: a new heaven and a new earth. We all live happily ever after. So we went through that overview of Bible prophecy, and if you'll come into next week with a pretty solid grasp on that, it will be much easier for us to bounce back and forth between deciphering the near prophecy that Jesus gives to the Jews there in the first century AD and taking the right interpretations out of that to bring into our present day and give us an idea of where things are headed. But I personally believe that two-sided reality approach to Bible prophecy doesn't need to start in verse 7. I personally believe firmly that the Lord wants us to take and apply that same method of Bible interpretation, prophetic deciphering, to verse 6 as well. There was, of course, a near reality for verse 6. We know that well here in this church. We're referring, of course, to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, specifically in 70 AD. But in light of how Jesus gives us the remainder of these prophecies with two realities in mind, I think it would be good for us to take even verse 6 and start to examine our own reality. Look around at our homes, our automobiles, our grocery stores, our department stores, even our anchored facility here, and understand that the message that Jesus gave to first century Jews is true to a great degree and an even greater degree to us today. It is all coming down. The economic system, capitalism, nationalism, it is all coming down. Your houses, your cars, all of your conveniences, it is all coming to an end. It is not going to last. Do you know that, church? I want to read to you a passage from 1 Corinthians 7:31. Paul said, "Those who use this world as not misusing it, for the form of this world is passing away." That is to get our living perspective on heavenly and spiritual things and not earthly things. Because as Jesus said to those first century disciples, I could say the same thing to you. Do you see all these things? Isn't that what Jesus said to his disciples? Lord, check out these stones. Check out this structure. And Jesus said, take a good look at it. Do you see all these things? It's all coming down. I could say the same thing to you. Anchored Fellowship, do you see all these things? Take a good look at it, because it's all coming down. Oh man, Trump lost the presidency, didn't get a second term. How long was that revival of nationalism and capitalism going to last anyway? It's all coming down. The Lord is moving us to something. And what he's moving us to is not material. It is spiritual. Another translation for 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 31 puts it this way. Those who use the things of the world should live as if those things are not important to them, because this world will soon be gone. I could not say it better than that. The Lord is moving us toward something. He has declared to us the end of all things, and that's why we shouldn't get too comfortable and cozy with material things. We should use them. Have a nice house. Great. Have a nice car. Use the things of the world, but don't misuse them. Don't get attached to them, and don't make your life about those things. Your life cannot be about material things. If so, you're in for a major heartbreak one day, because it's all coming down. By the time the Lord is done with this world, there won't be one thing stacked upon another. Second Peter chapter 3. I'm going to read verses 9 through 13. It says, "The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved in fervent heat, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening to the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. When does that happen? I just gave you the brief overview. When does this world melt with fervent heat and the Lord create a new heaven and a new earth? After the millennial kingdom. Not after the second coming. The second coming happens 7 years after the tribulation begins. The millennial kingdom lasts for 1,000 years. At the end of that millennial kingdom, the Lord wraps this up, and not a thing is gonna make it. This earth and the atmosphere around it is going to melt with fervent heat and pass away with a great noise. There goes your car and your house and everything else you own. Now, granted, this earth, as I speak to you this morning, has 1,007 years left at least. If the Lord returned in the rapture for the church right now, this day, there would be at least 1,007 years left of earthly world history to be carried out. So chances are your house isn't going to make it until that final moment, 1,007 plus years down the road. Certainly your car won't, unless you have a Toyota. See, I avoided the Ford and Chevy controversy there. Nothing material is going to last. Nothing is going to make it. Even our anchored facility is going to be gone. There's nothing to stop that. We could tear this down and rebuild it out of solid stone, but it's not going to matter, because one day it's all going to be destroyed. And so the question that Peter poses is the question that I want to leave with you today. Worship team, if you want to come up. Peter asked the question, now that we know everything material on this earth is going to pass away with a great noise and melt with fervent heat, knowing that all of these things visible to us are going to be resolved, what manner of people should we be? And he gives you the answer in verse 13. Here's what he tells you. Here's the kind of people that we should be. We should be people with an eternal perspective and not a material earthly perspective. As counter to our thinking as this is, as counterintuitive as it is true. You cannot build your life around the visible. You have to build your life around the invisible, the spiritual, the eternal, the heavenly. Only then will you not be disappointed. Only then will you be given something that will not pass away, but will be eternal in the heavens.